Thank you for listening to this audio recording from LimoPlanet 2020 Free the Future. The following talk was presented at LimoPlanet, the Free Software Foundation's annual conference on current issues in ethics, social justice, and technology. For more information on LimoPlanet, visit limoplanet.org/conference. LimoPlanet is a live conference with speakers who often use visual slides in their presentations. We have only selected talks for this audio feed that do not overly rely on visuals, but if you would like to see a speaker's slides, they are available at media.limoplanet.org. LimoPlanet speakers do not represent the Free Software Foundation. As part of our mission to show how important free software is to everyone, we have speakers talking about their use of free software in different kinds of political and commercial work. The FSF supports their freedom, but does not take positions on any political issues other than those necessary to uphold the principles of free software. Like all the FSF's work on behalf of the freedoms of all computer users, LimoPlanet is made possible by thousands of individuals who, like you, donate what they can. To keep this work going, please consider becoming an associate member via my.fsf.org/join or making a donation at my.fsf.org/donate. You can stay informed by subscribing to our newsletter, The Free Software Supporter, at fsf.org/fss.
I had to find the unmute button. Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for coming today. This is Room Monitor Jess, and we are about to begin a talk called Free Software Enables Free Science. And Paul and Joshua are going to be giving that talk. The session will feature a quick question and answer session at the end here, about 10 minutes before the end of the presentation. And I'll send a chat message when we're getting close to that, so you know. But please feel free to list any questions that you have throughout their talk, and I will gather all of them at the end. And so please engage in that way. So thanks again for joining us. And here is Paul.
All right. Hello, everybody. As Jess just mentioned, I'm Paul Gazzillo. Josh and I will be doing this talk together. So I'm going to go first. My name is Paul Gazzillo. I'm an assistant professor of computer science in sunny University of Central Florida. I started just a year and a half ago, and my research area is programming languages, software engineering, security. Made some kind of niche contributions in parsing and security and various stuff. So just to give a little context where I'm coming from, I started programming at a really young age. My dad is a huge nerd, so this is the actual computer that he had for me to program on, and he taught me this very weird language from IBM called Rex. So it was my first experience with that. But from that point on, at that point, this is still like the 80s, early 90s, where proprietary software was not like a huge thing. We'd just get a game on a floppy disk and I'd play it, and I really had no notion about proprietary software. It wasn't until I went to college and went to work that I really used Windows a lot and a little bit of Unix. And so I was sort of, in that world for a very long time, really oblivious to free software, oblivious to the FSF. And it wasn't until graduate school, when I started doing academic research, that I really got introduced to free software in a large way. It was actually through macOS first. There was a big influence in academia using Mac, but what actually got me excited about it is it was using Unix under the hood, and I had a little bit of experience with Unix, not a huge amount. And my advisor was big into Emacs, got me started on Emacs. I loved it because I could just fly through programming tasks. I could be really, really fast, really, really efficient. And so I didn't really come into free software through the philosophy. I was actually really unaware of it. I came into it because of the kind of power that it gave me over my computing devices. And since graduate school, I basically tried to do everything in free software as much as I could. Of course, not perfect. There's still a lot of non-free software and mobile, and there's a lot of speakers talking about this today. But now that I'm actually running a research group and doing education, I have a lot more choice to make and effect that I have on other students in what they use. And so the next step for me is there's a lot of good talks here about using systems as a service how we really don't have freedom when we use these services. And I kind of fell into using Google Docs and all these services. So I'm actually the kind of silver lining to this to this conference being online is that I hadn't heard about Jitsi Meet. I hadn't heard about Mumble. And now these are tools that I can actually use for my research group. Okay, so anyway, so about my job. I really love my job. I get to do both research and teaching. I get to work with students a lot. With research, the idea is to just come up with good problems, develop solutions, and make and disseminate that knowledge. With teaching, my goal is to teach core computer science principles to students so that they're prepared for their career in either industry or academia. And I feel like one of my main jobs is to really make students excited about programming computing and how much fun it can be and how much control they can have over their own device. So just a little marketing for UCF. UCF is in Florida, endless summer. It's a beautiful place. So if you have a chance, come visit. It's an excellent place to be. All right, so to get to the kind of main part of my talk, that was just a little intro about me. What's a little strange about academia is that the incentives are not exactly set up for doing free software. There's this historical notion in science that science is this open, community-based activity, and all ideas are sort of free and open, and everyone can have access to them. But the incentives in academia are not really for making software. Everybody's probably familiar with the phrase publish or perish. And that's fairly true. It's a little cynical, but it is fairly true. And so that means that software artifacts, the tools that people build out of research, often get left behind. And so even in sub areas like software engineering, ironically, most papers don't actually even produce a tool or data of any kind. And this is especially troubling because the research that I do and many of us in academia do is publicly funded by taxpayer dollars. So there have been some good initiatives, and part of the inspiration for this talk was this Rose Festival, Recognizing Open Science in Software Engineering. So I gave a very brief talk, 5-minute talk last year about this, about the importance of having good software that comes out of research. So the problem comes from this publish or perish mentality. So this is a very oversimplified, a little tongue-in-cheek view of how research in academia works. You get some idea. If you're in an area that I'm in, I don't do theoretical work. I do more practical work, more systems engineering work. You go to a machine, you write up your idea, you build software, you test it, you prove it. And then the research paper is what you get credit for. You disseminate that out into the world, notwithstanding open access problems aside. Research basically can get to the public. But the software often just gets thrown away. It gets left behind. Unless you're an academic who's really trying to make good software, the software is just a sideshow. And I didn't go into academia immediately after college. I worked for a long time as a programmer. And so I was very surprised when I talked to my advisor about this, and he said, well, you know, if you're interested in building good software, academia is not exactly the right place because, you know, not everybody cares about software. But I think this is a little bit of a shame and actually a little wrong when looking at the history of science. So if we look, you know, I'm a lover of history of science, philosophy of science. If we look at a very classic case of Newton's work in physics, everybody who takes physics in school knows about all the formulas that Newton came up with. And they just seem to have, you know, kind of be divinely inspired. You don't know where they come from. They're just the way the world is, and we learn about them. But it turns out, if you look at the history of how Newton and other scientists worked, they didn't just come up with ideas out of nowhere. As Richard Feynman, you know, famous physicist, said, if it disagrees with experiment, it's wrong. And so these ideas aren't just coming from divine. They come from real-world experience. And so on the right here, there's a scrap from Newton's notes on lens grinding. So in order to do his work in physics, he had to build a lot of his own devices in order to actually come up with real world science. And so I'm a big proponent of this in my work, and I'm a big proponent of this for my students. And I think it's really important for scientific work to make real world tools. And so there's this Professor Emery Berger. He's actually just down the road from FSF in UMass Amherst. Maybe it's a little farther than down the road. But he wrote a really excellent blog post. Maybe some of you have heard of him. He wrote some, you know, famous memory allocator, did some very good open work. And so he points out that if you want to have impact in scientific research, instead of just publishing papers, you should build real systems. Build real systems that solve problems in the real world. And really, this motivated me a lot to not just, you know, publish papers, but also actually make tools that are up to free software standards that can be used by other people. And I'll talk a little bit about my experience with myself not doing that in the beginning and how it sort of helped me in research to do that. So the main point I want to get across here is that there's this really strong parallel. If you take nothing away from this talk, I hopefully you remember this, that there's this very strong parallel, and I don't think it's accidental, between free software and science. Free software has these four philosophies. I've condensed them into three here, but it has the four philosophies of what makes free software: the freedom to run it, the freedom to study and change it, the freedom to share it, you know, either changed or not. And open science really has parallel philosophies here. So the ability to run it is just like reproducibility in science. So as scientists, we can't just tell someone how the world is. We need a way to have an experiment where someone can do that experiment, reproduce it, and prove it for themselves. And once we have those existing contributions, we can study the existing contributions, make new ones ourselves, and distribute those for others to use. And perhaps most importantly, there's this famous phrase that's embodied by this painting that you stand on the shoulders of giants to do even better work. And so this is where sharing and the community collaboration comes in. So both in free software and in science, collaboration is essential for doing good work and making progress. All right, so I'm going to talk both about my experience in research and in education, and then Josh will take over and give you the student's perspective about all this in academia. So my main setup for many years since graduate school has been, you know, the whole litany of mostly GNU tools, and also, you know, Python and some other tools from other researchers like Z3 and Picostat, which are, you know, they're theorem provers. They're for other purposes. They're for sort of research purposes, but they're open sourced with various levels of freedom attached to them. And even though for working on my own, I can use pretty much almost entirely free software, I'm very behind when it comes to collaboration. So in grad school, I largely worked alone. And so I really didn't have a need for using collaborative tools. But as I went along, other people decided for me what collaboration tools to use. So UCF uses Office 365 and Skype. And so I just sort of fell into using Google Docs and Slack and Overleaf. But hopefully that can change in the future. So hopefully the next things we want to try is using Nextcloud and Matrix, Jitsi, I hope. Because this is actually working out pretty well, this tool. All right, so that's the ability to run it. The ability to run it using all these tools has enabled me and other researchers to use all this free software as a platform for doing new science and making new contributions. But when it comes to studying it and changing it, during my grad school work, I had this research problem of trying to do some parsing of C and dealing with the C preprocessor. So technical details aren't so important here. But the problem I had was I had to replicate how part of the GCC compiler framework worked for C. And I struggled for days, weeks, trying to figure out how this tool worked until I realized that the source code is available. The source code is available to study how this works. So for various technical reasons, I couldn't take the source code itself. But being able to just go to the source code and see exactly how this tool is written allowed me to make contributions on top of this parsing and pre-processing work that is now, you know, open sourced and free software and public and for everybody to use. So being able to study and change software has been extremely useful for doing my own scientific work. But perhaps more importantly, the ethic of sharing work, both free software and the science itself, has led to much better collaborations and much better work for my own work. So originally I was in this kind of closed mindset where I made all of my work private. I would release it with the paper, but anything I updated, I did not want to release. I was embarrassed about my code. I didn't want people scooping me. I didn't want people being able to see my work in progress. But what changed my mind is the old version of my software that I had online, I got a random bug report from some guy who actually wanted to use this tool. And this really opened my eyes that, you know, I had been using free software for so long and I'd been buying into the whole development model, but I wasn't actually sharing my code or using it with making good giving it to a community that might want to use it. So work in academia tends to be a little niche. And so my thinking was, you know, who's going to use this? Who's going to use this tool anyway? And so from that point on, I started opening up my software, adding more collaborators to use it and making it open source, doing open development of this work publicly. And this kind of snowballed into further collaborations. So making it so that others can run and study and change the software allowed other people who are working on similar problems, even if it's a niche area, even if one or two people want to work on it, it allowed them to not have to reinvent the wheel, and we could work together and together, you know, do more work than each of us could do alone. And so there was this team at another university, a PhD student was working on it. I'm now co-advising him, but we were able to just work together on building these tools, these research tools, and even got a publication out of this, a new publication, which is what, you know, academics need for recognition in academia. And so similarly, a researcher, a professor who's interested in the same area, had an idea to improve the scalability and performance of the tool I've been working on. And he actually took time out of his own schedule to spend time working on my tool so that we could do collaborations in the future and make better tools. And so once I had opened up this project, you can see at the bottom here, you know, he had thousands of lines of changes, dozens of commits to make this tool better. But I found that this is still not quite enough. So it's all well and good to have a hacky prototype that sits in some repository that a few researchers who are working close together can use. Those collaborators are willing to put up with, you know, ad hoc buggy prototypes. But if these tools are actually going to benefit a larger community of researchers and users, they should not have to put up with ad hoc prototypes. And good engineering takes time. As I mentioned before, it's not exactly incentivized in academia, but it turns out it's really, really worth it, because from making a better tool, I was able to collaborate with another researcher who's also a Linux kernel developer, who gave me really good ideas about where the needs for this tooling could help Linux kernel maintainers and developers. And by having a tool that was not only free software, but also used the free software conventions and build tools and distribution tools, I made it something that someone could just, from the command line, download, install, run, without any ad hoc prototype hackiness. So the conclusion of this is that free software enables science, because instead of this kind of cynical model of, I just make a paper, I do enough prototype in order to get the paper out, then I let the software sit to bit rot. Instead, there's this iterative process of reproducing results, studying and changing those results to make novel contributions, sharing it so that others can build on it and make a better tool than I could or any individual could make alone, so that new people can then run that, make new results. And this leads to both good research papers and good software that can actually benefit society. And so even though only papers, you get mostly credit for papers in academia, this research is publicly funded, and public funding agencies like the National Science Foundation do encourage software to be made free and open source and publicly available. Okay, so that's my experience with free software and research. But what about education? The other half of my job is teaching students and preparing them for their own careers in academia or industry. And so my teaching philosophy has always been as a guide, teacher as a guide. So there's a couple ways to think about teaching. The kind of traditional model is that students are empty vessels, and this expert who knows everything about the subject just fills up these students as empty vessels, and they'll go off to parrot whatever the professor said. But my view is that the teacher is really just a guide in the student's own intellectual growth. So my view is that students are not empty-headed. They know what they want to do, they have motivations, they want to learn, and I've learned that even students who are struggling are actually trying to learn and want to learn. And what school gives them is a place to learn, the ability to learn and learn self-reliance in a safer environment than they would be if they were sort of put out into the real world and left up to the forces of nature, so to speak. So that's been my teaching philosophy. But the problem is, this kind of philosophy is very, very hard to do when you have mass education. Mass education is a great thing because we can teach thousands and thousands of students and give them a good quality education. But it's very hard to be a personal guide to everybody all the time. Ideally, each person would have their own personal tutor who would help them along in their growth, but really hard to do when you have thousands of students. Some of my classes have hundreds of students in just one class. But it turns out that the principles of computing that allow us to do automation make this much, much easier to do. So talking with a lot of excellent teachers here at UCF, I've learned that just simple things like being very consistent, giving clear expectations, communicating well, really help the student experience when in this challenging environment of mass education. And so to that end, this insight that I've realized is that free software is basically a standard or a convention that students can build on in order to go whatever career they want to go into, whatever tools they want to use in the future. Free software provides a really useful standard for the basis of computing, teaching computer science. And the reason is that instead of learning one particular proprietary system really well and getting stuck into a particular typecast into a particular type of job, free software provides knowledge that can generalize. So the reason for this is that there's endless opportunities for exploration. So like myself in graduate school, being able to look at the source code of tools to figure out how they work actually enabled me to do my research. And there's also enormous community support. So when you're lost in the world of mass education and you have no one to talk to, or you don't know how tools work, or you can't get support, you can at least find lots and lots of information on community websites to help you do your computing work. And also importantly, especially at UCF, many students come from low-income families, first-generation colleges. And even though I know that free means libre, not gratis, it's also gratis. So if you don't have a laptop lying around or you can't afford a $2,500 MacBook, you can buy a $50 or $100 8-year-old laptop and install software on it that's going to give you the full computing experience. And also instills this spirit of self-learning and being able to do it yourself, which is really what I'm going for in teaching students. So the main course that I've been teaching, the main undergraduate course, is called System Software. And it's supposed to teach students about compilers, linkers, and loaders. And it's mostly a compilers course for undergraduates. So it's a notoriously hard topic. UCF is still teaching all their introductory courses in C, which is a little unusual for most universities in the country. I think it kind of harkens back to their engineering background. But given that it's such a hard topic, and there are lots and lots of programming exercises, automation is just critical. When there are 200 students, there's no way anyone's going to sit down and grade those all individually. So this is where free software as a standard really, really helped out. So I standardized on GNU Linux, because everyone can use it, on C, Makefiles, and Git. So remarkably few professors here would actually teach version control or require version control. And so students really appreciated the fact that I made version control mandatory. So all software had to be submitted with Git. I used GitHub Classrooms. It was a nice, convenient tool. If there's other suggestions for options on how to do this on a large scale, please let me know. And then made it a requirement that their tool must compile with just running make. So this was just beautiful for doing automated grading, because all I had to do was say, OK, Git clone, run make, run a test suite. And voila, automation is done. It's very, very short scripts. And this is also really good for students because it provides a really consistent computing platform for them to self-evaluate. So rather than trying to wait a few weeks for grading to happen, I would just give a publicly available test suite, and students could see exactly where they stand and exactly where they're going wrong in their software. But one thing I noticed is that even computer science students who had been in the program for several years were very unfamiliar with using the command line. And so to me, this was actually quite unusual. I had kind of taken it for granted that computer scientists were just comfortable using the command line. And at the beginning, I just assumed that students would kind of figure out using Git on the command line, which is maybe a little crazy because it's a very confusing tool, and would just sort of figure out how to use Bash. And the ironic part here is that even though this was a course on system software, there was little instruction on actually using system software. So I ended up spending a lot of time doing basically extra tutoring for students, discovering that many students had never used the command line, not even if they were using Windows, Mac, was unfamiliar with simple commands. But this is, it's really important, as I heard from students, that learning these were really important for their future job prospects. Some students even mentioned that they, just by knowing version control, knowing Git, they were able to get jobs more easily. And more importantly, using the command line, being able to use all these tools, I believe gives students power, and it gives them control over their own device, so they're not just subject to the whatever software that they're expected to use, whatever toy languages that they're expected to use. And so this gave me the idea to just incorporate more operating system basics and even a little history. So I started going over, how the hardware and software is layered in most computing devices, and give a little history about the operating system history. So including, the Free Software Foundation and Linux, and also the case from a couple of decades ago about where the definition of what an operating system is became a legal issue in an antitrust suit. So it gave me the opportunity to give more information about that to students. But it turns out that most students are not using GNU Linux. Most students are using Windows, and there are some Mac users. But this provided yet another opportunity to give students more teaching on using system software, particularly virtualization. Virtualization is becoming ultra common in industry. Most students should have some basic understanding of how to use it. And it turned out that some students actually ended up just going to GNU Linux on bare metal because they liked the flexibility of using it in a virtual machine.
Paul, I just wanted to let you know we have a little bit less than 10 minutes until Q&A starts, since there's another speaker. I didn't know how long the two presentations are.
Perfect. Yeah. So we got about another 10 minutes just after this.
That's correct.
All right. So the next step that I'm trying to work out is making the content that I produce free and open. So this was uncomfortable, just like making software free and open source. I was uncomfortable making this recording all of my lectures, so it's just sort of a mental hump to get over. But it turns out that it's very easy to do. I can just screen capture my lectures, and it was really an important resource for students. Gave them less anxiety about missing classes. I think all students need lots of repetition and review. So I'm still working on this. I'm using YouTube right now. I'm happy to take suggestions for better alternatives for this. And kind of a bigger point here is that while colleges may never completely disappear, for those who especially can't afford colleges, it's really important to give lots of resources for students to be able to learn on their own. And so even if they don't learn all the content in college, instilling this do-it-yourself ethic, I think, is really important. So I take the feedback from students pretty seriously. I get lots of good comments, lots of bad comments. So the nice part is that students really liked learning real-world tools. So having this free software as a standard, I think, was really helpful because it allowed students to be able to talk confidently whatever jobs or whatever internships they go into. I also got some negative feedback, like lecture slowly, do more in-class experiments. Got some good praise. It's nice to hear the course is perfect, but that's obviously not actually helpful. Some students said I was boring. But anyway, I take it seriously what students say. I take it as a reflection on my own teaching and my own ability, and I was glad that students were able to pick up on that. So in conclusion, I think free software enables education. One of the main points is that free software is a standard for computer science education that can be the beginning of students' growth and learning self-reliance and learning to benefit from community sort and share alike. Okay, so without further ado, let me hand it over to Josh, who will give you some insight on the students' perspective.
Hi, I'm Joshua Santana. I'm a student here at UCF, and I do undergraduate research for Paul. And I just want to share my perspective on how free software has impacted me through my research and through my time here taking classes at UCF. Okay, so how I first got into free software, or how I got into programming, so let's back it up. So I was a kid. I was really into Minecraft as a kid, and I loved the game. But I really like to modify it too. So Minecraft, for those of you not familiar, has a big modding community where people find ways to enhance gameplay, add new mechanics, add new features. And when I discovered this community, I sort of started to learn Java a little bit, unzipping the jars, editing the classes, and adding new features. And it was all community driven back then, because like obviously the people who are distributing the game aren't supporting this. So it really got me into I really learned the idea of how sharing knowledge, sharing information, and just supporting each other through a community, you can achieve more than you could as an individual. So then going beyond that, going beyond the mods, I wanted to learn more about programming I just went on the internet and immediately, you know, I found that there were virtually infinite resources to learn programming. And computer science is something that I always found was really open and accessible, and just the knowledge is everywhere and people are constantly encouraged to share that knowledge. And it's something that I sort of started to take for granted at first, because I didn't know any principles like what free software was, what open source was. I was just taking advantage of these things without even knowing that they exist. And so I found that it was pretty easy to learn programming. I use MIT OpenCourseWare, which I think we mentioned earlier, and I would highly recommend that for anyone who wants to like get more into like the weeds of like algorithms or parallel distributed computing, stuff like that. They offer really great resources. So after, you know, learning programming, getting comfortable, I came here to UCF and I started majoring in computer science. And what I found immediately after starting my classes is that these free software attitudes and the free software philosophies are almost like the default that you will experience just coming in. Everything's really collaborative. People here, they work on side projects all the time. Students will create programs that are going to help you find parking, and they like hit up the parking garage APIs and they make ways to benefit other students, and people are always working on things together, sharing interview tips, sharing programming challenges, answers online, and distributing all the information. And there's just a really big sense of community here with the undergrads at UCF, and it transcends even just like the source code. Like, people just want to share knowledge in general, and they might not know that they're following these principles like that the freedom software movement sets out, or like the open source principles. So we can sort of be taking them for granted, and I think that it's important not to do that. Oh, let me go back. Okay, so let me shift topics to how I've used free software in my research, because I think this is really important. And how Paul touched on earlier, a lot of people who are computer science researchers, they'll create artifacts and they'll create programs to aid them in their research, but they won't share any of the tools that they developed or any of the source code, and they'll keep it to themselves. And then you have the paper, and you can read it and you can see what they did, and they give you an outline how you did it, but there's no way to replicate it. There's no way to, like, you know, stand on the shoulders of giants and build upon that to get new science out of it. So whenever I have found papers that did actually, you know, put their code out on a version control platform and put their code out to the world, I've been able to use that in my own research, and I've been able to build upon those artifacts to create new, better results. So free software just really benefits the scientific community because, like we mentioned earlier, it allows for reuse and it allows for improvement, and it just helps promote open science. So the key thing that I am taking away from free software is that it's something that, you know, like I mentioned earlier, like, it's already sort of almost a default. Like, we have this atmosphere we have of like sharing knowledge, open source, working together, working collaboratively. But it's important not to take that for granted, because, you know, when you go to work for industry, you might work for a company that wants to keep everything proprietary, keep everything secret, and not, you know, benefit the public, benefit the greater good. And I think it's really important to realize that these principles exist, that you should be applying them in your daily life, and that they are something that is worth fighting for. And that's really the main thing that I've taken away from my experiences here at UCF. And here are the picture credits.
Thanks. That was perfect timing. We have a lot of great questions here in the chat. So let's go ahead and start them a couple minutes early.
All right, perfect.
So yeah, the first one is, I'm going to ask two that are kind of similar. So I think I'm going to ask first, how do you break through the contracts that academic institutions have around working with particular proprietary software? And let me share some context around that. I'm scrolling up
okay. chat
here because there was a really nice story here. I tried to talk to researchers at the local universities here about making tailored software for their exact needs, but they were all tied up by contracts their university had signed. I had the same problem with doctors because they're part of a national network that has centralized health data, and this was a big disappointment. So, yeah, what do you have to say about that?
That's hard. So there's sort of the corporate side of universities, and they work like any, well, not any, but they're kind of like either a nonprofit corporation. And then there's the research side. So one thing that I was really happy about being able to work in academia is my work, I have a great amount of freedom, actually. I don't have, you know, NDAs or non-compete. I can make free software and I can make it, you know, GPL or whatever license very easily. But on the corporate side, you know, they have a contract with Microsoft, and that's what we use for email. That's what we use for that information. Florida has very strong Open Records Act, so I have to use that email for record keeping purposes. So I don't know. I don't really have a lot of insight into how those decisions are made. They are basically made in the admin side. So unfortunately, it's kind of a non-answer. But I can say that from the research side, from the professors, they actually do have a lot of freedom to using whatever software they want to use. And when it comes to using educational software, for instance, so I picked GitHub Classrooms because it was there. I was using GitHub. It was easy. So you can always kind of approach individual professors or departments to try to get software to be used. It doesn't necessarily have to be adopted by the corporate administration. I don't know if that helps, but.
Yeah. So in your experience, if someone with the question asker were to email the authors of a paper about the code that's in that paper that they published,
yeah.
how likely do you think they would be to just share the code, even if they didn't share it proactively?
Oh, that's right. So
I've actually done this several times, and this isn't like a scientific sample or anything, but I've never been able to get the code from some authors of a paper. And they'll give you like various reasons, like it's not available anymore. It's just our policy not to distribute it. But I think I've asked about 5 different authors and I've never been able to get code. But if there is a paper that does host their code on a version control system, then they're probably gonna link to it in the paper and it'll be available and you'll be able to just find the link there in the paper. And that's how I've been able to use code from that's the product of research, is because they actually reference the version control in the paper.
I would just add, ask. You should just always ask, because it's part of our kind of open science ethic that, you know, we're not, I think most, especially in computer science, they're not trying to like hide their code. It's just usually, you know, not incentivized to make the product. So as Josh said, if they're interested in making the product like real software, they're going to have it published anyway. And if it's old software, it might just not, you know, might suffer from bit rot.
Yeah, and so a lot of people in the chat have spoken in solidarity to what you've already said, that they're, you know, glad that they aren't the only ones that are having that experience. And said lots of nice things about your talk, so it was very well received. In case you weren't in the chat, I just wanted to let you know that. Kind of riffing off that, like, how do you make the case to others who are convinced that hoarding their data protects their own professional advancement? And do you feel that it's ever appropriate to call others out for not sharing their data?
Oh my God, I don't know. computer science is a little easier, I think, because go ahead, Josh.
Well, an argument I would make is here in computer science, a lot of our research is funded publicly, right, by the government. So the taxpayers are paying for the research that these researchers are doing, right? They'll get a grant from the NSF to work on some project, they'll publish a paper, get some code out, and But the taxpayers are paying for it. So what they do should just based on that be available to the public. And that's the argument that I would use for why they should be releasing everything and making it free.
Yeah, you have some of the same problems with that you do with just releasing software, that it's not what you get credit for. You get credit for papers. And so once you have the raw data, you know, that can be thrown away. Computer science is, I think, a little better about this. There's more people who are sort of in, you know, they want to share their code and data. But sometimes researchers are actually working with private companies in industry, and they're also restricted by industry contracts. I think you can tell people, you can talk to people about it. I think in computer science, people are aware of this. I went to when I go to software engineering conferences, usually when people don't want to release it, it's because they're under some sort of contract. I can't speak to the other sciences where I think there's more problem, you know, there might be other issues about getting scooped or things like this, but I can't speak to those other fields.
Okay, great. Thank you. And going a little bit broader than just this issue of sharing, but still within kind of the same, is software ethics a subject that's being discussed in classes at UCF?
Josh, do you see it being discussed?
No, not in my experience. I've taken about 12 CS classes, and I haven't had any discussions on software ethics.
I believe there are. So there's this engineering organization called ABET, which accredits engineering universities, and I believe they require ethical content and courses. I don't know if it's particularly software ethics, but they do require some like technology ethics. I don't teach those courses.
There probably is an ethics course offered.
There are.
Required for any major that I'm aware of, but there probably is a course.
It's meant to be incorporated in their course material.
All right. Here's a more specific question. Which tools do you use for screen capture and video recording?
I was actually using, so I actually have a Google Pixel book that I've been using for class.
Okay.
Because it's got a virtual machine. It is Chrome OS, which I actually kind of like Chrome OS. It's very efficient. But I was just using some plugin for Chrome that captures the screen. It's kind of buggy, but it works. That's what I was using. I'm not particularly sophisticated. If I would love to hear suggestions, any suggestions for like improving the education experience, I'm happy to take it, particularly free software stuff.
Great. And then we have a fun one here for Joshua. A question asker asked, I have a 5-year-old son that loves Minecraft. Would you play a level hacked by your mother?
Yes, I would. Yeah, that sounds like a lot of fun.
All right, and there's one last question that I have here, and please in the chat, if I've missed one, if you could bring it back up for me. I tried my best here to get them all. There was a really great conversation going on there. And that question is, when I was 20, C++ was taught with Turbo as the IDE. Last year, I retook the class and CodeBlocks was the IDE. What IDEs are recommended for those who want a cross-platform free software experience?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't recommend an IDE for anyone like taking a class, because your projects probably aren't going to be like so big that you actually need an IDE to do all the building and stuff. I would just recommend using a free text editor that has syntax highlighting and just building using some cross-platform tool that would work. So if you're doing C++, like GCC, I think you can use anywhere, right? Sure. Or Clang. Yeah, just use a text editor. You don't need an IDE. There's plenty of free text editors that are available with syntax highlighting to get all the features you need.
And then I think, did one of the speakers ask for YouTube alternatives?
So Media Goblin.
Yeah, Media Goblin was recommended here.
Yeah, I think I did try to use it, but I was having trouble with encoding. Encoding videos was a massive problem for me. I do use Emacs, actually. That's my IDE. I haven't used an IDE in I've gotten away with it for a very long time, not using an IDE. It's all Emacs for me.
And I kind of have a question. There's a little bit that's been talked about reproducibility, both in your presentation and in the chat here. I'm wondering what you, I guess this could be a whole separate presentation, but what you do to make your research data reproducible.
Oh yeah. Well, it's basically using the same conventions that I just sort of absorbed when using free and open source software.
The best thing that I see that you do is document it very
oh, yeah.
well.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, documentation is really important.
I think for anytime you have source code without documentation, it's always a struggle. So I definitely appreciate when the authors of papers, you know, publish their tools along with documentation. And I know Paul's like, I use his tools all the time. They always have really great documentation.
Yeah, I try to. I have this idea. You know, it's the same way if you can, like, same way you use package managers. That's like my ideal. If my software can just be installed with a package manager or Python setup tools, that's my ideal. And that means the README has just got to have like a list of five commands you have to run. And if I can make it so that it's just that simple, that, you know, like any other high quality free software can do, then I'm happy. That's what I go for. And it just takes a lot of software engineering time. I don't know if there's any one way to do it. Just use standards like setup tools for Python, use make or whatever is in vogue now for build systems for C software, auto tools, autoconf. Just use whatever sort of standard.
Yeah. And then for reproducibility, also making sure that you're not hard coding anything that people need, like any paths that are, you know, only for your system, and making sure that it's like you can run it anywhere.
Those are great tips. Thank you so much. We don't have any more questions here in the chat, and we're about up for time here anyway. So I just wanted to thank you guys for a great presentation. And
thank you.
Are you in the chat? Do you want to share your information or anything?
Sure.
Any final words here?
No, I think that's it. I'm glad. This is my first time at LiverPlanet. I'm sorry. It's too bad we couldn't go to Boston.
We'll go to Boston next year.
We'll go next year.
Yeah, next year.
I've been a member for like several years, an associate member. I've been trying to contribute, but I never really had anything to talk about at Liver Conference. So just glad that you guys are holding this. This is awesome.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for a great conversation. Bye, y'all.
Bye.